Hi, this is Dark Journalist. Today I'm excited to welcome back best-selling author Jim Mars to the show. Now, Jim has written some of the true classics of alternative research, and today we'll focus on one of those classics, the blockbuster Alien Agenda, that set the tone for deep research into the fascinating topic of UFOs. We'll also explore his most recent research, which contains some shocking revelations that will definitely shake up the mainstream view, which lives in denial as a result of a massive cover-up. Now, Jim has traced the ET presence all the way back to ancient times, and believes we're looking at genetic engineering scenarios as far back as the period of Moses. Some of these revelations involve the enigmatic pharaoh Akhenaten and his bizarre prophecy. Does the past hold the keys to our future? Here we go. Jim Mars, Akhenaten, Alien DNA, and Remote Viewing UFOs.
You mess with this stuff long enough, and you're going to really realize you're down the rabbit hole. The UFO phenomena did not start in 1945 or 47, okay? You can go all the way back through history. You can go back to Ezekiel, the fiery wheel in the Old Testament. Moses, by the way, is not even a name. It's a title. And Moses, back at that time, was translated as the true pretender to the throne. So Moses was actually Akhenaten. He tweaked the DNA and he kind of developed the, improved the breed with the Anunnaki female who carried it to term and produced what was a hybrid.
You know, as we proceed into the 21st century, our culture and society are debilitated by a lack of understanding of the subject of UFOs, off-world civilizations, and the advanced technology that they represent. The secrecy, in fact, has become so absurd that the average person now believes that the government and media are lying to them on these sensitive topics. And they're right. But lately, we may have seen some cracks in that wall of secrecy, from Pepsi commercials featuring the Black Knight satellite of UFO lore, to the latest admission by NASA that they may have found the elusive Planet X, long championed by the late UFO researcher Zechariah Sitchin. There is a sense out there that even traditional institutions and corporations feel that UFO denial is unsustainable, and that we need a new view to match a new era. But the covert gatekeepers are more committed than ever to keeping the truth and the advanced technology to themselves. What are they so afraid of, and what are they trying to hide? Let's go ask Jim Mars.
Dark Journalist will go there. The deepest issues, the hardest stories, the biggest secrets. The truth is never easy. With top guests, like former Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz.
Catherine, who is really behind this media censorship?
Internet feeds go through satellites. Who controls the satellites? It's the Pentagon.
Legendary investigator Graham Hancock.
Graham, this cataclysm must have destroyed an advanced culture in our ancient past.
It truly was an extinction-level event. It was accompanied by massive animal extinctions. It was accompanied by huge and unexplained sea level rises, and then a sudden plunge of global temperatures.
Best-selling author Jim Mars.
Jim, don't these elite corporate owners need us around to buy their GMO food? Why would they want to depopulate?
Because they are eugenicists and they believe that they need to purify the human race. And if that sounds like the Nazis, that's exactly what it is.
Coast to Coast AM investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe.
Linda, how are we going to scale that wall of UFO secrecy?
Humans themselves are bypassing, are beginning to dismiss all of the policies of denial and lies.
Dark journalists will go there. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special winter discount available for just $39 for one full year. You'll not only receive access to the complete audio archives to stream or download at your convenience, you'll also get exclusive subscriber-only content and Dark Journalist event discounts. Sign up for our free newsletter to stay updated on the latest shows. Dark Journalist, let's get the real story in 2016.
You know, we need dark journalists, so just keep doing what you're doing.
Jim, it's great to have you back on the show. I spent some time rereading your classic book, Alien Agenda. And of course, we did a conference together recently where you presented on this subject.
Right.
And I was just impressed with the amount of whistleblower testimony, cases, reports, photos, videos, and just the sweeping picture that you create of a totally fantastic and unexplained phenomena, which is just now a part of our everyday reality, whether or not the media or the government even want to acknowledge it.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, we'll go deep into ancient times to find the roots of this modern mystery based on your very latest research. But let's start with a case that you brought to light originally in the book, and that's the Maury Island case, which I think is rife with strange connections and is really a telling case when it comes to why there's so much secrecy around this topic.
There's some incredible crossovers and tie-ins there, right?
Oh, yeah. Kenneth Arnold investigates the case.
Yeah.
And it's right after he's had his major sighting. And we also have Fred Chrisman involved in this.
Fredley Chrisman.
We know he has a strange history.
And Guy Bannister.
Right.
Both of whom end up in New Orleans mixed up with Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yes, and that's off the charts. Now, how do we square these unusual connections between the deep state and the space program? Because we know that Oswald himself was telling every one of his coworkers who would listen at Riley that he was going to work for NASA. So what is it that all of these links represent?
Yeah, the NASA connection with Oswald is really fascinating. The fact that he said, told people there at Riley he was going to go work for NASA. Well, this ties into what Jim Garrison was telling me one time about that he went, several people there at Riley who had worked with Oswald, and he was trying to get them to come and testify at his trial against Clay Shaw as being part of a conspiracy to kill Kennedy. And there was like three or four of them. And all of a sudden they all got offered better jobs at the NASA facility outside New Orleans. And they said, for national security reasons, they wouldn't allow them to come and testify.
Oh, unbelievable.
Well, thanks a lot. So again, there's huge, mysterious military industrial intelligence connection between Oswald, NASA, and the Jim Garrison investigation.
Well, it is interesting to revisit the public's attitude towards UFOs during the JFK era. Of course, you know, there was a real learning curve going on there at the time. They'd had huge waves of sightings in the 40s, but things like the Roswell incident, for example, didn't even get revealed until the 1980s.
That's true.
At that time, no one even knew about that. So at the time, what we had were contactees, you know, people who would come out and talk about their communications with benevolent entities or even beautiful Venusians. And then the character of the UFO phenomena changed with the abduction case of Betty and Barney Hill.
Right.
Now, how did that alter the terrain?
Well, first I was looking up here in Alien Agenda. I've got this incredibly good quote before we get totally off of Kennedy.
Oh, yeah.
From Bill Holden. Who was the loadmaster for Air Force One.
Yes.
I believe it was in the summer of 63, I suppose. I think when Kennedy went to Europe and made his famous Ich bin ein Berliner speech. And it seems that there had been some UFO incidents in Europe, and they were making some headlines around there. And so this Bill Holden told me that Kennedy was actually pretty approachable. You know, he was a good guy.
Right.
And said while they were on Air Force One, he approached Kennedy and he said, what do you think about UFOs, Mr. President? And he said, Kennedy became quite serious, thought for a moment, and then said, I'd like to tell the public about the alien situation, but my hands are tied.
Hmm.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Aliens. And of course, this also gets into the issue that Marilyn Monroe, right before she died, had told friends that she was going to tell secrets that she had learned from Kennedy, both of the Kennedy brothers. And the number one secret she talked about was she said President Kennedy had journeyed to a secret airbase. I figure this is Area 51.
Okay.
And viewed things from space. So he knew. He knew. In fact, there's a real interesting tie-in there. Back in the 40s, there was a government group called the Interplanetary Phenomenon Group, which when I first heard about that, I said, oh, that's just got to be some kind of joke, you know, but it was very real. It's been documented. There are documents now found from this group. And in 1947, they actually produced a report on the Roswell crash. And it is pretty specific and pretty out there. They talked about two different landing zones, LZ1, LZ2. They talked about multiple bodies being found. They talked about the whole thing. They gave names, dates, places. They also were the first that I know that mentioned that before the crash in Roswell, there were all kinds of sightings around New Mexico. And in fact, they had been picking up unidentified objects on their radar. And it was becoming quite a concern to them through the first part of that week in July preceding the crash at Roswell. But in the back of this report, it said one of the few members of Congress to have knowledge of this is Representative John F. Kennedy of Massachusetts.
Huh.
And it said he had served in naval intelligence. I was an officer in Naval Intelligence, and that he apparently had a source of information within the office of the Secretary of the Air Force, Secretary of the Air Force, I guess. At that time, it had been the Army Air Corps. Now, that's true. Most people only know Kennedy's background as being the commander of the PT-109, right, which he got sunk by a Japanese destroyer in the South Pacific. But it's true that prior to that, he had served in Washington with Naval Intelligence. So see, that tells you that this is a legitimate report. And that tells you that Kennedy, as far back as 1947, knew that the Roswell was the real deal and that something very unearthly had happened there. And then that leads to the story of these two guys who worked at photographers worked at Area 51. They tell the story that they didn't get to go down into the underground levels to find out where all the really top secret stuff was, but that they did work there as photographers and that they were privy to the lunchroom, employee lunchroom there, and said they would go in there and there was in the lunchroom and there was they got to see and meet some of these Nazi paperclip scientists, okay, and other people who were working in this deep underground. And they tell in the fall of 62, I believe it was, that the buzz was going around that the president was going to make a visit. And the attitude was kind of, oh, well, you know, don't worry, you know, we'll give him the dog and pony show and he'll go away, you know. And then afterwards, they said the tone totally shifted and that there was everybody in there was angry and that the word was is that Kennedy had threatened to cut their funding. And they were all grousing and complaining about him. Okay. So to me, what this tells me is that Kennedy probably did go visit Area 51 and probably was given the usual tour. Nothing here to see, you know, yeah, we just have some experimental aircraft and nothing here. But since he had known since 1947 that the crash was real, there were bodies, I think he probably blew up at him and said, look, you're not telling me the truth. I'm president of the United States. I'm going to cut your budget. I'm going to, you know, you guys need to start leveling with you. And as a matter of fact, I think that might have been one of the straws that broke the camel's back. And I think there were people, military, industrial, and intelligence people, higher ups at that time that said, this guy's getting out of control, you know, and he's going to blow national security secrets. We better see that something is taken care of here.
Well, it is fascinating to consider that we have whistleblower testimony on the record that Eisenhower was actually telling the people at Area 51 that he was going to invade that base with an army division if they didn't tell him what he wanted to know about the UFO technology that was being researched there. So we see there again that power struggle between the executive branch and this kind of breakaway civilization military force that's there using this technology and actively reverse engineering it.
Right. And I think, for my money, Eisenhower was probably the last president that was fully briefed on the ET UFO situation. I think with that, once Kennedy got in, they figured they could smooth it over with him and you know, put blinders on him. But see, he already knew. So that caused him a problem.
Right.
Now, everybody else, Johnson, of course, was their boy, bought and paid for, so he wouldn't give him any trouble. And then everybody else, they're going up to Richard Nixon, right? Mm-hmm. And that gets to the Jackie Gleason story. Jackie Gleason, the famous comedian, told his wife and told close friends, and then even told a fellow that I met personally, that Nixon had taken him to a secret air base and they had seen things from space. Okay. So Nixon knew about it too, but probably only to a limited degree. And then you get to Jimmy Carter and we find out that Jimmy Carter, well, at first you had Gerald Ford, our unelected president. And there's an interesting story there in that early on back, I'd have to look and see what it was, but I think it was in the late 50s. That there was a huge UFO sighting up in Michigan, his home state. And they sent J. Allen Hynek up there, who at this time was a famous astronomer who working for the government. And he made a press conference and said, oh, it was swamp gas.
Right. That's the classic right there.
Classic. And in fact, that's been a joke ever since. You know, it's always swamp gas.
Right. It's swamp gas or weather balloons. They're sort of neck and neck on that.
Yeah. Well, the idea that they had all mistaken swamp gas for UFO so enraged those people in Michigan, understandably so, that they got on to their representative, Gerald Ford, and said, you know, this is not right. Gerald Ford went public and said, I'm going to convene some committee hearings in Washington, and we're going to study this UFO thing. We're going to find out what, get to the bottom of it, find out what's really going to happen, you know. And then all of a sudden, nothing happened, you know. There was never any hearings, never anything more. But he got to be our unelected president.
Right.
So, he, you know, he kept his peace and they took care of him. OK. And then Jimmy Carter, if you'll remember, campaigning, said that it was asked about UFOs. And he said, I've seen one, you know, and he gave a very detailed description of seeing this UFO. And he promised that he would it got to be president, that he would tell the people, he would find out the truth about UFOs and tell it to the people. But then that didn't happen either.
Yes, right. He backed off.
And then you come right on up. Of course, Reagan, he didn't get a chance to do anything because they shot him right away.
Exactly.
and George Bush pretty well ran the presidency there for a while. And then poor Reagan, he got Alzheimer's. He forgot about it. So then we get to Bill Clinton. Okay. Bill Clinton sent his old golfing buddy, Webster Hubble. He appointed him an associate attorney general of the United States and sent him to the Justice Department. And in a book in his biography, Hubble says, Bill told him, he said, Webb, I'm sending you to the Justice Department because I want you to find out two things for me. He said, I want to find out who killed Kennedy and I want to find out what's the truth about UFOs. And Hubble said he did not feel he was able to get to the information on either one of those.
Right.
So see, even the president of the United States, there are secrecy levels even higher than the presidency.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned President Carter in there. If we look at that era of the 70s and the openness, the kind of intense interest around the UFO subject, you know, we even had the movie Close Encounters, which was a huge blockbuster hit that was directed by Steven Spielberg. So you can see there was a real appetite in the public's mind for this topic. The Betty and Barney Hill case became a TV movie. So it was all going mainstream. And by the time you get into the 80s, there are movies like E.T. that really carry that wave along. And by the time we get to the 90s, you know, you're looking at abductee research. Everything is about abductees. And then a Harvard professor comes out, John Mack, and says, I'm studying abductees and I'm actively researching this program. And that kind of blows the lid off of everything. You know, even Time magazine tries to pen this guy back into a cage and get control of the situation. So it was a pretty wild period.
And that was really interesting, too, because there at Harvard with Mr. Mack, he had credibility and he had credentials. In fact, they tried to shut him down. You know, they set up a peer review or some kind of review committee there that were saying, you know, basically is like, what is this nut saying here, you know? And it's interesting because I think they were after his job and his head, and they got neither one because they said, well, we're not sure we believe all this stuff, but his methodology is correct. And apparently these people are saying these things. So basically, you know, he's saying people are being abducted by aliens. And they reviewed it and basically left him where he was, which to me tells us that he's telling the truth. And these people are telling the truth as best they know it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the amazing number of cases that he had where he would lead a patient through a hypnotic regression and help uncover these suppressed memories of those contacts. Really fascinating work. And I was lucky enough to meet Dr. Mack, and I felt like he was a really stellar professional. But Mack was probably the most legitimate person dealing with this topic. But then we also had people like astronauts Gordon Cooper and Edgar Mitchell, who sadly we just lost. They came forward and said many of their fellow astronauts know more, and the military understands that off-world visitors are a part of our reality now. And so they were trying to break through with this. At that point, I'd say in the late 90s, we were on the threshold of a new paradigm. And then after 9/11, it became all about terror. But there is that awareness still lingering there.
Well, there's been a whole, I call it a conditioning process. We've been conditioned to begin to accept all this. You go back to the 1950s and you'll find that the national poll showed that the vast majority of people disbelieve there's any kind of life outside the Earth. And that's why when people started talking about science fiction, mainstream people and mainstream media just said, well, that's ridiculous. There's nothing there. And it was just a very small niche, of people that were trying to be serious about UFOs. And in fact, and even then, the people who did believe in UFOs, their big burning question was, well, do they come from Mars or do they come from Venus? But as we got into the 60s and we got into the government investigations the Hills, Betty and Barney Hill, their story, which was intriguing because up until then it was just lights in the sky. And now all of a sudden here's people talking about seeing real physical aliens who had taken them and taken them aboard some alien craft and all like that. Well, that really struck the public consciousness, maybe more so in the field of entertainment than in true news, but at least it was increasing the consciousness. So by the 60s and into the 70s, the question became not whether they came from Mars or Venus, but do they come from Alpha Centauri or Zeta Reticula 4? We expanded our consciousness. We got a little more sophisticated. And then, of course, now into the 90s and into the day, we've even gotten more sophisticated because there are legitimate questions now about, well, do they come from another planet? Or do they come from another star system? Do they come from another time? Do they come from another dimension, And personally, I think the answer is yes. All of the above.
All of the above.
I think that the Earth has a somewhat interesting position in the universe. And I think a lot of people are interested in who we are and what we're doing. Some maybe more from a beneficent viewpoint than others, but all of them, I think, are kind of intrigued by us.
That is so interesting. Well, one of the big breakthroughs around this was retired military personnel started coming forward. So on one side, we had a prestigious academic like Mack from Harvard University coming forward and confirming this. And then on the other end of the spectrum was someone like Lieutenant Colonel Philip Corso, who confirmed, in fact, that the military had reverse-engineered UFO technology. And he almost immediately came under a firestorm of criticism from the military, from the media, and certainly never could be said to have benefited in any way from coming forward. Quite the opposite, actually.
That's true. But, what's funny is that I've talked to some of the people like Colonel John Alexander, okay, who worked with Corso, knew him quite well. And he says he kind of disses his accounts of dealing with aliens and alien technology and like that. But then on the other hand, he tells me, yeah, but he was a real honest guy, great guy. And I was just like, wait a minute.
Some things just don't add up.
Kind of a disconnect there, Yeah, he's an honest guy, but don't believe what he's saying.
Right. Huh. Now, what do you think about Colonel Corso's revelations about military awareness of ETs?
It comes back to mindsets. Okay. It's your mindset. Philip Corso, for example, Colonel Corso, he was a World War II guy, okay? Mm-hmm. And then he was operating in his prime during the Cold War. Well, everything was national security and everything was watch out. There's communist spies everywhere, you know, blah, blah. So I remember one time when I was interviewing him, I said, Colonel Corso, in your book said, you tend to leave the impression that that these visitors, these people coming around, these UFOs, that they're hostile. I said, you know, what makes you think they're hostile? He said, well, he said, they would fly over our classified military installations. We'd order them to stop, and they wouldn't stop.
Huh. Yeah, so it's a kind of militaristic us versus them viewpoint.
That's the World War II national security state view of everything. If you don't understand something, it's got to be an enemy.
Exactly.
And that doesn't, you know, that doesn't, that goes all the way back.
So these military officials really had that attitude in the 40s from a war-torn point of view, that these were hostile encroachments into our airspace. And that's just the way it was in that period.
And it didn't get much better, because what you find is in the early 50s, we had a secret UFO war.
Oh.
Okay. It was in the early 50s. The military sent out orders to their pilots. If you see a UFO, shoot it down. Because they want to know what they were and they want to get hold of the technology.
Well, they probably had a few crash retrievals and they wanted more.
Yeah. So then, and this was late 40s, early 50s, they said, shoot them down. And then there was a period of about a year or so there where I have detailed a whole number of mysterious air crashes, airliners that crashed.
Strange circumstances. You know, right.
And then all of a sudden the military said, they sent out new orders and said, if you see a UFO, don't shoot at it. Okay. Said, you know, just report back. And airliner crashes.
They stopped. Yeah, that is just one hell of a coincidence. But since we're in the realm of crashes here, we're all familiar with the Roswell UFO crash. And there are others in that era, one at Aztec, New Mexico, which has also had some excellent investigation done on it. But you were the first person to highlight a crash that took place in your home state of Texas, and this crash took place in 1897, so it may be the oldest crash on record. Now, can you tell us about the Aurora crash?
What I have here is the entire front page of the Dallas Morning News for April the 19th, 1897.
Right.
Okay. And in the middle of the page, right here, is the story of the Aurora spaceship crash. And it says, about 6 o'clock this morning, the early risers of Aurora were astonished at the sudden appearance of the airship, which has been sailing through the country. It was traveling due north and much lower to the earth than ever before. Evidently, some of the machinery was out of order, for it was making a speed of only 10 or 12 miles an hour and gradually settling to the earth. It sailed directly over the public square and when it reached the north part of town, collided with the tower of Judge Proctor's windmill and went to pieces with a terrific explosion, scattering debris over several acres of ground, wrecking the windmill, water tower, and destroying the judge's flower garden. The pilot of the ship is supposed to have been the only one on board, and while his remains are badly disfigured, enough of the original has been picked up to show that he was not an inhabitant of this world.
Huh. Now,
this is 1897. Now, of course, the debunkers have all said, well, it's just a fake story. Somebody planted a bad story, you know, all kinds of things. Well, the railroad bypassed the town, and they were trying to get more, you know, get people to come in there and get some attention to the town. What they don't point out is there are 16 stories on this front page, every single one of them, and they range from southern Oklahoma all the way south to almost Austin, Texas. And they, every one of them is talking about this thing flying through the skies.
Oh, that's okay? Pretty wild.
This is 6 years before the Wright brothers flew.
Right.
There's nothing man-made in the air. That's why I call this the smoking gun of UFOs. But back to the question about precincts, you know. I've got to read you what happened in Granbury, Texas.
All right.
Granbury, Texas, April the 17th. Newt Grissom last night at 9:30 o'clock while drilling the Riddle rifles discovered the mysterious flying Jenny of which we've heard so much. Newt is a very warsome young man, being a populist, but he could not stand the sight of the air machine, so he ordered the company to open fire on the object, which it did, and the whole town was soon aroused.
Oh, just amazing. A documentation on that, and 50 years before Roswell. So we've been dealing with this for a long time.
Right.
Now, one thing that has always intrigued me is the sheer number of cases by nuclear weapons sites. So what is the attraction, and why are they showing up there? You know, they seem to have this affinity for those locations.
Right. Well, this is simply because if we're shooting each other with bows and arrows or even bullets or cannon shells, that just stays right here. That's us. You know, hey, you do what you want to do. But when we start setting off nuclear explosions, this sends perturbations of energy throughout the whole universe. I mean, you know, this is when you're messing at the atomic level, you're messing with the basic building blocks of the universe. And I think that got them concerned. My line is that after we set off an atomic bomb in Alamogordo in spring of 1945, and then two atomic bombs on Japan in August of 1945, I think that sent wavelengths out through the universe. And I think somewhere somebody said, oh my God, the kids have found the matches.
So we got their attention.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to look at how our national security state decided to handle this. Of course, one of the most intriguing ways we sought to get intelligence on this whole arena was using a method originally developed by the Russians in their super soldier programs. And that involved psychic spies.
Yeah.
And we know it by the name remote viewing now because of declassified documents that show we had this program going on. And now we've developed some of the best remote viewers. And one of these men, his name was Ingo Swan, he came out and discussed how he was recruited to view these large-scale bases on the moon built by some other culture. Now, it's well documented that he was in this program, but some of the things he viewed there and what he said about it, it was really shocking.
Oh, yeah, very much so. In fact, when Ingo Swan, I met him and on several occasions and was in his apartment there in Manhattan. And he's telling me about naked humans working on the moon. But hey, so much of what they did has now been proven to be true. I'm not the one to say that's just balderdash, you know. In fact, Ingo Swan, another fellow whose name escapes me at the moment, in the early 70s, decided they, because remote viewing is not limited by time or space. You can go look back in time, you look forward in time, you look out in space, and you look in here. They decided they want to take a look at Jupiter. So they both did this separate remote viewings, and they all came up with pretty much the same information. And they saw that Jupiter had a ring around it that we can't really see, but it's there, and that it has a magnetic field, which we didn't know about, and that there is clouds on Jupiter, and under the clouds, they see big mountains, okay? Well, at that time, they tried to, you know, they put out this information, and the scientists, the astronomers, they all went, well, that's interesting, but who knows? Because we had no way of verifying whether it was true or not. But in the late 70s, they sent the Voyager mission out there. And the Voyager went out, circled around Jupiter and took all these photographs and all these measurements and readings and everything, sent all the information back. And by golly, everything they said was verified. So this
incredible accuracy.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, their credibility is pretty strong.
No question. And as I understand it, Swan was essentially the best remote viewer that we had, and he was the real prototype for the program.
And he was good, but I wouldn't say he was the best one. What Ingo did, though, was he was one of the early ones to start actually experimenting with it and working out the protocols to make it work.
Uh-huh.
And so in that regard, he's basically, I would say, almost the father of modern remote viewing. But then he was building on the shoulders of others like the people there at in the universities that had been working with.
Russell Targ and Hal Puthoff.
He was working on it. And I'm thinking of even the ones who were at the University of Kentucky, where those man and wife that were working on remote viewing, or except they didn't call it that. They called it clairvoyance. And you go all the way back, you find at the time of World War One in the 20s, spiritualism was a big fad.
Right, right.
And they were having seances and they were doing all this stuff. But again, they were just playing with it because they didn't know what it was. And as you so correctly said, credible remote viewing has only been developed since the 70s, probably.
Amazing. Well, one of the crucial things about Swan and this book he wrote about remote viewing the moon and these bases called Penetration is in there he describes being grabbed by an intelligence agency to do this under some pretty secret circumstances.
Yeah.
And this idea about a base being up there that's not one of ours.
Right.
You know, for so long, we've been curious why they haven't gone back to the moon. You know, why have they slashed the public space program at NASA? Now we know.
Yeah, exactly. Especially when it's my understanding that after we quit going to the moon, we still had 22 Atlas rockets capable of putting men on the moon, but we never went back. And the explanation they give, I think, is pretty thin. They said, well, there's nothing much there. It's just a dead world. And we don't think we're getting any value for our money. And it costs a lot to go there. And we really just can't afford to do that. Well, excuse me, but that's like building a Rolls Royce from scratch and then say, well, we can't afford gasoline. We can't drive it around anywhere, you know. And by the way, if you think bases on the moon or something, how about bases on the Earth?
Sounds pretty wild.
In the remote viewing program, one of their early candidates to learn and remote viewing and who apparently was quite accomplished at it was an old police detective named Pat Price.
Pat Price, right.
And and one day Pat Price showed up unannounced and nobody had ordered him to do this, but he shows up at work one day and he said, hey, I did this remote viewing session and, you know, there are four alien bases on the Earth. And he proceeded to describe them and even told where they were. One of them is Mount Perdido in the Pyrenees Mountains between France and Spain. Another is Mount Inyagani in Zimbabwe in Africa. Another one is under Mount Zeal in Australia. And then another under Mount Hayes in Alaska. And he even described what they were doing there. As I recall, the one in the Pyrenees was kind of an operational base. This is where they'd come and go and get orders and stuff. Mount Inagani in Zimbabwe was like a repair shop. That's where he went for, you know, if you needed repairs. Mount Zeal in Australia was, I think that was the R&D. That's where several species would go for a rest and recreation, you know. And then the Mount Hayes in Alaska was a environmental monitoring station where they were monitoring the Earth and the atmosphere and I don't know, you know, pollution and all the stuff, what's happening to the Earth. Well, that was all fine and good. But of course they had no way of proving up any of this stuff. So they said, well, that's interesting. They filed it away. Later on, as it became more and more of a official military unit, the SciSpy unit, they had a training officer named Skip Atwater. And Atwater told me that one day he was deciding to give these remote viewers as they're testing kind of an exotic target, you know, not your usual military aircraft or some landmark somewhere. And he happened to dig up the file that Pat Price had left about these bases. And so he tasked them to go look at, see if there's any alien bases on the Earth. And of course, you know enough about remote viewing. He didn't say, go look at alien bases. He just gave them a number.
Coordinates, yeah.
Coordinate number, 51206071, okay, which meaningless except to him. He knows in his own mind that that refers to, I want you to go look at these alien bases. And when you do that, you have a thought pattern that goes out on the universal energy grid. And when they get that number, then their subconscious mind is already drawn to this thought pattern. And so supposedly then they are guided to the target. Okay, well, they all came back and they said, wow, there's four alien bases on the Earth. And they named the name Zimbabwe and Pyrenees and Australia and Alaska gave the same thing and described what was going on there. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, fascinating. What do we do with that kind of information? But really, the idea that they have bases here makes perfect sense.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And these places are so spread out that you won't find a base in a major metropolis.
Right. And they're underground. They're within mountains and stuff, you know, and unless you stumble across it, which chances are you're not. Even if you do, I'm sure they've got doors and locks and camouflage and God knows what else that's going to assure that you don't get in there, you know.
Yes. A strange footnote to this story is Pat Price will die under very strange circumstances. You know, a stranger brushes against him in a hotel lobby, and a little while later he develops an illness and dies. So that's very unusual.
Yeah, that's true. Well, there's still some strange stuff going on with remote viewers because, see, the government is scared to death. They do not want the public to clearly understand that we all have this psychic ability, and that if we work with it and get it really reliable, that we can find out all the government's secrets. We can find out everything that they are doing. And then when they come out and announce that, Syria just blew up an airliner, you know, and they go do a remote viewing, say, no, it's a false flag. You know, oh, boy, they don't want that. So they have gone to great lengths to try to denigrate the story of remote viewing. In fact, they even, came out with that film, The Men Who Stare at Goats.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that one?
I think it was 2009.
George Clooney. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that movie was not that far out because some of that stuff they really did. But what they did was in their experiments trying to figure out how this worked, they did some crazy things. They tried to see if they could kill a goat by staring at it. They tried to see if they could run through walls. They tried to do all this stuff, you know, but that was just fringe stuff, just stuff off the wall they'd try. And so they put the weirdest stuff together and make it like it's a humorous movie so that everybody sees it and goes, ha, ha, that's pretty good. And boy, they're idiots. And boy, it didn't work. That's the whole thing. They didn't tell you about the ones that actually worked and the things.
Right.
Perfect. Because they don't want people to know they can do this.
Well, Jim, don't you know there's no such thing as psychic power?
Oh, of course not. We all know that. just like I was taught that there's nothing on the moon. There's no air. There's no water. You know, there's just nothing there. And now, all of a sudden, over the course of my lifetime, there is some water seen and sprays drifting across the moon. And, well, yeah, it does have kind of a slight magnetic field. And it and yeah, you know, and like right now with Mars, oh, that was a dead planet. There's nothing there. And now, all of a sudden, they're going, well, there's water there.
You know? Right, exactly.
If they quit doctoring the photographs and turning them with a red filter so they all look like a red desert, we might find that there's trees and grass, all kinds of things on Mars, you know. But, of course, when they tell me, and that was within this year, I believe, when they suddenly announced that we think there's water on Mars, it wasn't a surprise to me. I mean, all you got to do is look at it. There's ice caps, right? There's a white cap in both poles. But Mars, well, what else would that be but frozen water? You know, of course Mars has water.
There are researchers like Richard Hoagland who think there's much more than water up there, that there's ancient ruins. Now, yeah. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I tend to think so, too. If you look closely at some of this stuff, in fact, you can go onto the Internet, Google images and say anomalies on Mars or buildings on Mars, ships on Mars. You'll find all kinds of photographs of weird and odd and strange looking things. Now, I'm not going to say that all show buildings and artificial structures. Some of the ones I look at and go, you know, it's like a rock to me.
Right.
You know, but then there's others though, that it's like, whoa, that cannot possibly just be some kind of natural object, you know?
Jim, what about the face on Mars?
The face on Mars, though, is actually kind of an interesting study, too. You know, they came and they got it at an overhead angle. And, of course, the clarification, magnification wasn't all that great. But it certainly looked like a face. And that kind of slipped out. And then that went all over the Internet. And everybody's going, wow, looks like there's a human face on Mars. And then NASA, in an attempt to try to disparage that kind of talk, because that was starting to crack open their secrecy, they took a picture of it from a low angle where it just looked kind of like a series of ridges, you know. I said, no, there's nothing there. It's just a natural thing. And so that has gone back and forth, you know, and people have photoshopped it and they've added shadow and depth and everything else, and it's still not really clear. But if you look at the Cydonia region of Mars, where this face is, you see pyramids. And the pyramids are in the same configuration as the pyramids on the Giza Plateau.
Amazing.
And the same pyramids outside Mexico City. So this is pretty suggestive evidence that they were all made by the same people.
Yeah, and that pattern is so fascinating to decipher. Mm-hmm. Now, when we come back, I'm going to ask you about this off-world connection in ancient times. You know, are we seeing indications in the advanced cultures of the past of some high-tech assistance? And is there a spiritual dimension to this phenomena? We're coming back with Jim Mars. Stay with us.
Go deeper with Dark Journalist. Subscribe now and you'll have access to the complete audio archives to download or stream at your convenience. Receive advanced updates and discounts on Dark Journalist events. Enjoy exclusive subscriber-only content. Go deeper with Dark Journalist. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special winter discount, available for just $39 for one full year. Dark Journalist, the truth is never easy.
Sitting there filming, a little saucer came from, a saucer came flying over their heads, put down three little landing gear and landed right out on the dry lake bed. And they picked up their cameras and started over toward it, filming as they went. And when they got in fairly close to it, it lifted up, put the gear back in the wheel wells, tipped up, and took off at a great rate of speed.
Dark Journalist will go there.
What are they so afraid of? And what are they trying to hide?
Hidden technology.
In other words, the possibility exists that you have here a machine that is manipulating magnetic fields on a planetary scale that has nothing to do with particle physics.
The black budget.
But there's no such thing as getting away from the corruption, because it is literally, it is now integrated into every economy in the globe.
Geoengineering.
I'm talking about right down to the DNA level. Imagine that you have now put microprocessors and sensors, along with everything else, into every human body, every animal body.
For more interviews, special reports, and documentaries, visit darkjournalist.com today. Dark Journalist. The truth is never easy.
And we are back. I'm Dark Journalist, and I'm speaking with best-selling author and investigative reporter Jim Mars. Jim has written really some of the best books on deep politics, and he's pushed the envelope by going into controversial areas like UFOs and hidden technology. His major blockbuster on this is the book Alien Agenda, and his new research on off-world visitors is edgier than ever. Now, Jim, we were talking about ruins on Mars that look very much like archaeological sites in Egypt and Mexico. If they are ruins from that period, then does it suggest a UFO link with our ancient past? What do you think happened back there?
You have to understand that the UFO phenomena did not start in 1945 or 47, okay? You can go all the way back through history. You can go back to Ezekiel, the fiery wheel in the Old Testament. You can go back to the flying boats of the ancient Egyptians. You can go to the Bahamas of the Hindus in India. You can go to the Dogon tribe in Africa and their legends, the Aborigines in Australia. It goes all the way back. People have talked about these things flying through the air. In fact, talked about people coming from the sky and giving them, imparting language and mathematics and architecture and all kind of agriculture, all kinds of stuff.
Right. Now, can you think of one of these ancient stories that stands out in your mind?
Okay. One time I tried to figure out where did we get beer? You know,
right.
I can understand wine. There's some grapes that fell off, laid on the ground under the sun, got pretty fermented, and some very thirsty caveman came along and said, oh, I'm going to try these anyway, got a buzz and said, hey, this is great. So I could see where wine came from. But beer, you got to have malts and hops and various chemicals, and you have to mix them just right. And you have to ferment them. You have to add sugar. You have to, you know. It's a complicated formula.
It's pretty advanced, yeah.
Yeah, how did man come up with that? And as best I could find, it tracks back all the way back to the earliest civilization that we know about, and that is the civilization of Sumer and the Sumerians, who lived between the Tigris-Euphrates River over there in what is now Iraq, and which, by the way, has been noted by a lot of Christian researchers as being the site of the Garden of Eden.
Right.
So, I mean, it goes back as far as we can. What did they say? They in their writings, which were on clay tablets, which thousands of them still exist, and they have been translated, they said they had four kinds of beer, okay? And I'm sure none of it was light.
Yeah.
But they had four kinds of beer, and when they told how they got to beer, they said they were told how to make beer by the Anunnaki, which translates those who came from the heavens, landed on the earth. And the Anunnakis evolved into their gods. And, of course, today you can read all about them in the Encyclopedia Britannica, but you have to look under Sumerian mythology.
Mythology, right. Okay?
So what's happening today, though, starting with Zachariah Sitchin and others, that they say, well, maybe it's not mythology. Maybe they were actually telling us what they knew to be true and what they had experienced, and that these people came down from the stars and told them how to do things.
Well, what do you think of the influence of the Anunnaki at that time? Do you think they were benevolent, or would you suggest they were more of a negative presence?
I think it evolved. I think early on they may have been benevolent, and then, number one, obviously at some point they dropped out of sight. They either all left or they quit dealing openly with humankind. And in fact, as Zachariah Sitchin details, how that they had created kingship. So in other words, they were making hybrids, okay, and these hybrids, which were part human and part Anunnaki, they would set them up as their representatives, so they didn't have to dirty their hands on the nasty old humans.
I okay? see.
And so this started the whole idea of kingship, and it also at the same time set up almost a religious order, the priesthood. Okay, and the priesthood were the only ones who could talk to the gods. And the king was their representative, okay? And then I think what happened was at some point these ancient aliens, these Anunnaki, that they either all left or a few of them may have stayed behind, but they dropped out of sight and they weren't in direct contact with the humans. And I think that this created a problem for both the kings and the priests, because, you know, now they had to, now the manifest gods that were very real and that people had direct contact with are now just concepts, you know, the spiritual type.
Right, right.
They're still there. They're still there, but we can't see them. We can't hear them, but I'm the priest and I can intercede for you. And I can tell you all about it. Okay. And I think that's where it might've gotten a little bit skewed, because these priesthoods and these kings, they got pretty used to all that power and control, and they didn't want to give it up. So they began to institute more and more regulations and more laws and more ways of controlling the people. And until it got to like the Middle Ages, where the Roman Church was in charge of everything.
Yes.
They loaned money to the kings and queens, had them under their control. And they, of course, every town and village had a priest, and the priest would hear confessions. He knew all the dirt on everybody in town. And they had the church had pretty much dominating control over everyone. And it's been a slow evolutionary disconnect from that time on. Today, of course, the organized religions are in kind of decline, and because more and more people are waking up and assuming their self-empowerment, and they don't necessarily feel they have to listen to the priest, you know.
Right. Well, thinking of these older priesthoods, if you're dealing with an off-world culture and you become their representative, after they leave, you're kind of keeping the power structure intact.
Exactly.
Now, when you look at the advanced technology that built the Great Pyramid, for instance, or the Mayan pyramids, which are so advanced astronomically, do you think that's an off-world culture giving us that technology?
Yes, I think so. And it's kind of been lost. I think they were using energy manipulation. Okay. And I'll give you a good example of that. It's right there in the Old Testament of the Bible. And that's the story of King Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon.
Yes.
And, you know, at one point he was the ruling guru and he had this whole huge empire there. And it was built on the remnants, degraded remnants of the Sumerian empire, you know. And at one point in the Bible, according to the story, he built a structure of gold, out of gold. And that gives all the dimensions, and it was kind of like a big phone booth or something. But he had a problem because when his people would go in there, they would sicken and die. So I think what that tells us is that and gold is a highly conductive metal. And so apparently in some way they had built a energy field within this chamber. And so he wanted to use it, but he was scared of it because everybody he sent in there would sicken and die.
Interesting.
So they went to Palestine and they got the three Hebrew priests, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, brought them to Babylon. He says, okay, you guys are priests. And you probably have the knowledge passed down from the Anunnaki. You know about this thing. I want you to make this thing work. And they said, well, you're not our king. You don't believe in our God. We're not going to work for you. And he said, well, then I'm paraphrasing, but he says, okay, well, then, you better make it work because I'm going to put you in there and you'll die, you know, unless you make it work. And so what's really interesting is right there in the Bible, it doesn't say that they just threw them right in there or that they walked in there. It said first they donned their raiments, their cloaks, their hats and all this stuff. Well, you know, wait a minute. What's that got to do with anything? Obviously, there's something very special about clothing. Okay. So they put on radiation suits. Okay. Or whatever. And the three of them went in this chamber that has been translated as a fiery furnace, but obviously it wasn't a fiery furnace, so they were burned up.
Right.
It was some kind of gold structure that created a energy field. And they went in there and Nebuchadnezzar says, he didn't want to get anywhere near it. So he says to his minions, you know, are they in there? And they said, oh, yes, O king. He said, all three of them? He said, well, no, actually, there's four in there.
Whoa.
Four? Where'd this fourth guy come from? He says, who's the fourth one? And he said, a son of God.
That's so wild.
And that's the last we hear of it.
Huh.
We don't know where this son of God came from or who he was or where he went or anything else. But see, to me, that tells me they had advanced technology. They had created a wormhole or a stargate or some kind of force field that allowed them to go into another dimension or whatever. But we do know that the Bible says that he was so impressed with whatever the three priests had done that he put them in charge of Babylon.
Wow.
So in that, see, I think that's evidence that there was some real exotic technology being used in the far distant past.
Something from before.
I think this energy had been handed down from the same technology that had been used to build the Great Pyramid, where they were able to either through sound or sonic vibration or maybe some kind of magnetism, they were able to lift those huge stones and maneuver them into position. This idea that a bunch of slaves could drag a 6,000 pound rock through the desert for miles and miles on wooden rollers just doesn't hang well with me.
Yes, absolutely. And the stones used to build the pyramids come from a totally different part of Egypt. So right. That explanation is completely false. But it is fascinating to consider, I guess the most obvious reference in the Bible to this ancient advanced technology is the Ark of the Covenant.
Right. And what was in the Ark of the Covenant? White powder.
White powder. Intriguing.
Mm-hmm. And what was the white powder? That was the monatomic gold.
Okay.
And it was useful for many things, but what they have found in recent, because it's only been rediscovered in the last few years. And what they find is that when they reduce physical gold through a smelting process, it can be reduced to a white powder. And when they've got this white powder, they found something very extraordinary. When they put it on a scale, you know, in the weighing pan on a scale, the pan weighs 44% less than it did before you put the white powder in.
Wow.
So this white powder has anti-gravity.
Fascinating.
Okay. And also, apparently, it's a great conductor. And so the idea is that this white powder was in the Ark of the Covenant. And number one, that was useful as a communication device, because if you'll think of the biblical stories, they were able to talk to God. And the voice came out of the seat of the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant. Now, another thing, you see the engravings and little pictures they've drawn. You've got four or five guys carrying, you know, the Ark of the Covenant around. And yet, if you read it, that mercy seat, the lid was made of solid gold, and it was so many inches thick, so many inches wide, which would translate into more than 2,000 pounds. Well, you know, four or five guys are not going to carry a ton around very easily. But if it's filled with the white powder,
it's floating,
and it's got anti-gravity, it's kind of floating, and they're not carrying it. They're just guiding it.
Yeah.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yes, absolutely. And it reminds me of the story of Moses when he leads the Hebrews out of Egypt. There's this funnel cloud that follows them into the desert and feeds them manna. And that's floating like a cloud in the air. It feels like the description of a massive UFO sighting.
And what was manna? White powder.
Right, exactly.
They would wake up in the mornings and they'd find this white powder strewed across the ground, and they thought it came from heaven.
Right,
you know,
right.
Where did it come from? It must have fallen out of the sky. And they would take it and they would add a little water and mix it up to make a dough, and then bake it and make bread and pancakes or whatever. And that's what the manna. In ancient Hebrew, manna translates as, what is it? They didn't know what it was, but they knew it was good. They knew they could eat it, and that's what sustained them. Now, where'd they get it? They got it from Moses.
Yes.
And how do I know this? Well, because in about 1914, the British archaeologist Sir William Petrie said he had discovered an ancient Egyptian temple on Mount Horeb in the southern Sinai, which is also known as the Mount of Moses. And he said in there they had a smelting operation. And he said when they pried open the flagstones on the floor of this temple, that there was all this white powder. And they were wondering, what is it?
Yeah.
Same thing. They didn't know what it was. And of course, they left the stones open and the wind blew it all away, you know, so they never really knew what that was. But that was the white powder. And that's where Moses was manufacturing it and then using that to feed the Israelites as they wandered around and conquered city after city in the desert. And that brings us back to the story of Moses. And we all know the biblical story, how that, you know, the Pharaoh of Egypt had ordered all male children killed. That doesn't make any sense to begin with. You know, if these are your slaves, do you kill off all their kids?
Right.
Destroying your own property. And then, of course, we're told he's put in a basket of bulrushes and floated down the Nile to a family that raised him and saved him. You know, what's interesting is the Egyptians have the exact same story. All right.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not Moses. It's Amenhotep the third. Amenhotep the fourth, who then later became Pharaoh and changed his name to Akhenaten.
Yes, the Pharaoh Akhenaten.
The worshiper of the one true God.
Right. And we should say here that his reign as Pharaoh of Egypt is one of the most unusual. Of course, his worship of one god, the Aten, depicted as a sun disk. Pretty interesting imagery. But we can't even imagine how radical it was at that point to put the old Egyptian gods and priesthoods out of commission by proclaiming the Aten as one god.
Yeah, and then in the Bible it says that he was schooled, that Moses was schooled in all of the secrets and all of the protocols of Egyptian royalty. Why would they do this to a slave, you know? So the idea is, what I'm telling you is that Moses, by the way, is not even a name. It's a title. And Moses, back at that time, was translated as the true pretender to the throne. So Moses was actually Akhenaten.
Really? Now, that's fascinating.
So, and what happened was, is that Akhenaten the fourth, his dad, Amenhotep the third, did not want any pretenders to his throne. So what he ordered was any of his mistresses or any of his many wives, if they had a male child, they were to kill it because he didn't want any competition for the throne. So when one of his wives gave birth to Amenhotep the fourth, obviously that's their child. They don't want to kill him. So they secreted him away. And this is all in the Egyptian records and writings. They put him in bulrushes. They floated him down the river to the home of their servants, which would have been the Israelites, the Hebrews. Okay. So he was raised by a family of Hebrews. That's where he was indoctrinated with the concept of the one true God.
I see.
And then after he got old enough, and when Amenhotep the third finally died, well, then he probably came forward and said, okay, I'm now the Pharaoh. And they accepted him because they knew it was true. And he became Amenhotep the fourth. But he changed his name to Akhenaten, okay, the believer, the one true God. Now, that put him at loggerheads with the priesthood and with all the various gods that they represented there in Egypt. So they had a real problem because he's causing them a problem. But he's the Pharaoh. He's a god. They can't just kill him or whatever, you know. So they decide, though, that they're going to exile him, and they forced him to leave, and they told him, okay, we're sending you off, but you can take whoever you want to. Well, he took not his birth family, but the family that raised him, these Hebrew slaves. And he's told them, you know, take what you need, and we're all leaving, and that's when he let them out, and that's where we get the story of the Exodus.
It really is an amazing story. And again, Akhenaten is etched there in our consciousness, even though when they removed him from power, essentially in a coup, these priests try to eradicate his memory from their history. You know, they smashed the Temple of Aten to rubble. But strangely, he, his wife Nefertiti, and his son Tutankhamun, or King Tut, are probably the most well-known and popular ancient Egyptians. Now, why is that? It's quite an enigma.
Right. Right. He was going against the grain.
We also have the 20th century American psychic Jean Dixon, who made some major predictions about Akhenaten and Nefertiti having this major impact upon the 21st century. So if Moses was Akhenaten, and there is an off-world connection there, as we discussed, it could explain his bizarre physiology.
Right.
I guess one other detail I should mention here is that they believe now in Egypt that they've found Nefertiti's tomb, and it's adjacent to King Tut's tomb.
I've seen that. I don't think they've actually done it yet, but they think they're on the trail, right?
right, exactly. Now, when you look back on that Egyptian history, and we know the earliest version of the Bible actually has its roots and comes out of that ancient Sumerian text.
Right.
As time goes by, it appears that it becomes more and more fragmented, so that by the time we get down to the modern era, some crucial information seems to have been lost.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Let me draw the parallels between the story of Noah and the Great Flood, and then the account of Utnapishtim, who was a Sumerian, who was told by his guy, and this is all in the Sumerian tablets, which still exist. It's the same story. His God comes to him and says, there's going to be a big flood. You need to build a boat. You need to build it with pitch and bitumen and, you know, and blah, blah, blah. In fact, the stories from the ancient Sumerian to the story in Genesis are virtually identical, which tells me that the Bible story narrative was simply carried on from even earlier, probably verbal, stories. With two significant differences. One was simply the name. In the Old Testament, we get the name is Noah. In the ancient Sumerians, there's actually, I think, two names. The one I can still recall is Utnapishtim. And I can see why they changed it to Noah. It was going around talking about Utnapishtim. But the second change, to me, is very, very significant. In the Old Testament Bible, of course, we're told that Noah took two of every animal and all the plants and everything on the earth and put them on the ark, right?
Yes.
Well, even as a kid in Sunday school, I'm going, wait a minute. You're telling me the lions and the tigers and the gazelles and the zebras all on the same boat together and they're all eating together? Wait a minute.
Yeah.
One to eat the other. Come on. And, you know, besides that boatload of animals, where do they go to the bathroom? You know, it's just had to be a mess.
Right.
And so the answer is in the original, the ancient Sumerian tablets that tell the same story, they don't say that he took two of every living thing. They say he took the seed of every living thing.
Ah.
And once you understand that they also write about in vitro fertilization, and the fact that they were able to make a hybrid by taking the ovum of a earth primitive and fertilizing it with the sperm of an Anunnaki male and then implanting it in the uterus of a Anunnaki female who carried it to term and produced what it was a hybrid between the two races, which they call the Adama, Adam, if you will, the earth.
Sounds familiar.
Okay. Yeah. And once you understand that they had a knowledge, a working knowledge of DNA, then what we have here is instead of a boatload of animals, you had a closet with DNA samples so that after the flood went down, they were able to come out and then repopulate the world with the animals and plants and everything else that they had the DNA for. Isn't that interesting?
Yes. And that description does sound very high tech. I mean, because basically it's a DNA lab.
Right. Exactly. Well, and that would have been Inky because you find he had a laboratory in South Africa. They call it the Abzu. And, you know, then you have the story of the Anunnaki who came here and they were trying to mine for gold. And they originally trying to get gold out of the Persian Gulf, you know, by panning for it. But that's a slow, laborious, inefficient process. And they weren't getting the amounts of gold that they wanted. So they started excavating and mining. Okay. But now you're down underground, you're working, it's hot, it's dirty, and that's tough work. And they had some problems with labor because these guys were saying, hey, we signed up to be astronauts, go to a different world. We didn't sign up to be miners.
Right.
You know? And so there were some work stoppages. And what I'm telling you is all recorded in these ancient tablets, which still exist and which nobody really denies that it doesn't say all this. The only difference is that, like I said, you find a lot of this account under Sumerian mythology. And there's more and more scholars who are now coming to the understanding that this is not mythology. This is what actually happened and they were recording it. Okay. So they had a big meeting of the leaders of the Anunnaki and they said, what are we going to do about this labor problem? And of course, needless to say, the hawks were there saying, well, you know, let's just, you know, kill them, you know, execute them if they don't work. And Inky, who I tag as their science officer, said, well, now, wait a minute. I've got this lab down in South Africa, and I've been working with these earth primitives, and I think that I can maybe tweak their DNA, and I can produce for you a worker race who will do all this grunt work and relieve the situation, and we don't have to do that anymore, or our people, you know. And what's interesting is they had the same ethical arguments we're having today over cloning and things like that. And they're going, well, wait a minute, you know, it's not our place to play God. Only God can create people, you know, and species. And that's interesting, too, to show that these apparent aliens also have the concept of a universal creator or God.
Right.
But and Inky finally convinced them. And, you know, they said, we can't do this. We can't play God. And he said, we're not creating anything. We're just improving the breed. Okay. Same thing we do today with cats and dogs and horses, you know, we're just improving the breed. So don't get the idea that we are the creations of aliens. No, but they tweaked the DNA of earth primitives and they came up with this hybrid race, which is us.
That is fascinating.
And in fact, science now tells, as you well know, the story of Lucy, mm-hmm. that they have found the earliest human female in South Africa and that everyone stemmed from her, right?
Yeah.
Maybe she's the one that Inky worked on.
It could be the prototype.
It all fits once you really study this. But see, as you can see, You have to have a broad view. You have to look at all of this stuff and throw it all together. If you concentrate on one little area or one thing, if you concentrate on theology, concentrate on biblical study, concentrate on ancient astronauts, you don't get the whole picture.
And you can't be afraid to go there because it will be challenging.
You got to keep an open mind and you got to think about what makes sense and what doesn't, you know.
That's definitely true. And just to tie up that Enki part, his counterpart was Enlil. And there's some suggestion that what we have here is a kind of good versus evil scenario playing out.
Well, I'm not sure it's good evil, but what you had was Enki, who, if the stories are correct, he tweaked the DNA and he kind of developed the improved the breed with this hybrid. And that was his little laboratory experiment. And he liked them. Okay. And he thought they were kind of cool, you know. Wanted to take care of them and wanted to help educate them and stuff. Enlil was the mission commander, and he didn't want to be distracted with these stupid humans. And besides that, they started procreating.
Right.
And so he wanted to get rid of them, and Enki was a little more benevolent towards humans. And so, yeah, that's where you kind of have a dichotomy and a difference of approach there. But I don't know. It depends on how you want to view it. You know, it could be, you could see that's good. You could see that's evil. You could say whatever you want to.
Well, we can see this early influence from these advanced beings on our culture in that story. Of course, even in our own Bible, there are unusual characters that strongly suggest otherworld connections. Now, Enoch is certainly someone who would fit that mold. We know that his books were actually banned from the Bible because they were too controversial.
Yeah.
It's too much information, apparently. What do you think of Enoch?
Well, there's another one, Melchizedek.
Yes.
You know, and about all we get is that Jesus was a disciple of Melchizedek. Well, wait a minute. If Jesus was the Son of God and he was a disciple of Melchizedek, this guy, what does that make him? You know, it's, yeah, there's a lot of mysteries there. And I think the problem is not with the Bible, that, you know, a lot of people believe that it was inspired by God. And I'm not going to argue that, but it's also been edited, re-edited and condensed and changed around by men. Okay. In fact, most of the Bibles that we're reading today stem back from the original Bible that we've had since the time of Shakespeare, which is the King James Version. And in fact, it says that right there on the title page, the Bible according to King James. Well, wait a minute. Nobody ever said King James was the Son of God.
Yeah.
And if you'll go and study that, you're going to find something really fascinating too, a whole different view of things there, because King James, he was not a scholar, okay, but he decided that he wanted to put the Bible in some sort of readable order and some kind of established orthodox narrative that everybody could work with. So he got these 45 scholars to translate, correlate, and as you say, like the Book of Enoch, they didn't know what to do with that, so they tossed it out. And several other books, there was a Book of Mary, it went. And of course, that had been going on ever since the Council of Nicaea and other gatherings since the Bible came into existence. But these 45 academics, they are the ones who prepared the King James Bible. And I think you probably could get the idea that if they came to a passage that said, throw off the kings, they're working for King James and they like their heads. So, you know, chances are they might change that a little bit to, you know, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's.
Right.
Okay.
Well, that's an excellent point. Of course, over time, we've had secret societies and ancient brotherhoods preserve traditions and methods of attunement from a real antediluvian period. So there have been groups like the Rosicrucians and later even the Theosophical and Anthroposophical societies where, you know, they really had this sense of the old mysteries. Now, where do you think this stream of Western esoteric influence is coming from? Do you think that these underground communities were descended from these ancient mystery schools from Egypt, you know, where they knew so much about magic and physics and the old advanced technology?
Yes, absolutely. And the thing is, though, see, they, you go all the way back. This is why, for example, In the Old Testament, you've got people who are actually Abraham and others who were having direct contact with God, supposedly. Moses goes up on a mountain, talked to God, got the Ten Commandments, which, by the way, he broke.
That's right, yeah.
Right? He came down, they were worshiping the calf. He got mad, he broke them, you know, and he had to go back to the mountain and say, gee, Lord, I'm sorry, but I broke your Ten Commandments. You know, could you give me another set? And God says, no, you're just going to have to, you know, reconstruct it. So that's interesting, too. Oh, so yeah. These Ten Commandments that we have, you know, this is from somebody's memory. I think this is what it said.
Yeah, good luck.
But they had this direct knowledge. So they knew they were real. That's why some of these religions, some of the Hindus, maybe even the Jewish religion, they are adamant in their religion because it's been handed down through the generations that they had direct knowledge of a physical God. And they knew it was real. Okay. Mm-hmm. All of us, we've been brought up just with this, nebulous, spiritual type God. We know he's there, but we can't see him. We can't talk to him. We don't know exactly what's going on there, but they actually did. They had direct contact. And I think that the ancient civilization, starting with Sumer through ancient Egypt and Greece and Rome, that these secret societies were trying to hold together the knowledge that had been passed along from these Anunnaki all the way down. But of course, through the wars and revolutions and mass migrations and everything else, a lot of that got lost.
And fragmented. Know? Yeah.
Yeah. For example, the alchemists, we all know the alchemists were looking for the philosopher's stone, which has been badly translated as the cup, the chalice that it held the blood of Christ. Well, I think that's something somebody made up. Okay. If you go back and actually read some of the material from these they were alchemists. One of them, for instance, says that the philosopher's stone is actually gold reduced to a fine powder. So they were after the monatomic gold is what they were. And they knew from that knowledge handed down from the past that it was possible to take gold and transmute it into this powder. But they had lost the formula. They didn't know how to do it. And then that got twisted around to where today what we hear is that they were trying to take base metals like lead and change it into gold, and maybe they were okay, but I think it started off with their effort to try to reconstruct the formula for reducing gold to the white powder, to the monatomic gold.
Now, what is it about gold? You know, what is this mystical property in gold that seems to supersede everything? We have it in the Anunnaki story, in the Bible, of course, it's everywhere. Certainly in the Middle Ages, right up to today, there's this gold obsession. What is the reason for this fascination?
It goes far beyond just the fact that it's a precious metal, right? I mean, there's other precious metals, you know, diamonds and rubies and silver, and, you know, they're all precious. But they don't come close to gold. There's something about gold. And the only thing I can tell you is that the Anunnaki, from the very beginning, they were after gold.
Yes.
So from the very beginning, there was an understanding that gold is somehow precious, desirable, perhaps even holy. Okay. And according to the Sumerian tablets, the reason for this was, and this is really interesting, is that they were needing gold to repair the atmosphere of their home planet, Nibiru. And the reason that's interesting is because early on when we began to have problems with ozone holes in our own atmosphere, none other than Dr. Edward Teller, the father of the H-bomb, you know, he said, well, you know, perhaps we need to put pulverized gold in the upper atmosphere, which will reflect UV rays and hold down global warming and help repair these ozone holes. So maybe that's exactly what they were trying to do. And that's why that the gold had a much more powerful usage for them than just trinkets. And that's why that all the way down through all the civilizations, all of whom, see, I found this amazing. I'd been taught in school. I knew about the Babylonians and the Assyrians and the Phoenicians. And, you know, I always thought these were separate empires and separate civilizations. It starts with the Sumerians, and then it degrades into the Babylonians, and then into the Assyrians, and you can track them all the way down, and then to the Egyptians, and then to the Greeks, and then to the Romans, and finally down to us. And it's been a devolution rather than an evolution. Okay,
that's true.
And that's why it's kind of funny, because, you know, here today we think with our computers and lasers and stuff that we are the apex of technology in this world. And so, but I think actually we're only now getting back to the level of some civilization that existed long before our recorded history. And the remnants of that are found all over the world. The pyramids, for example, and the Sphinx. I had heard this argument, and then when I went to Egypt, I saw it for myself, and it's very real. On the Sphinx particularly, and on the Great Pyramid, there are very obvious evidence of vertical erosion, which can only occur through rainfall. If it was windstorms, it would be horizontal.
Right, right.
This is a very vertical road, and the only way that can happen is through having the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx sitting out under very heavy rains for many, many years, okay? Well, the geologists will tell you that there has not been any significant rainfall on the Giza Plateau for more than 10,500 years. So that tells us that the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx were existing 10,500 years ago or more.
So they're the creation of a much older culture.
That leaves out the Egyptians, because the Egyptians were only here 5,000 years ago.
Definitely.
But see, that shows, though, the breakdown of our so-called science. No, you know, nobody wants to really investigate something from an objective standpoint, because they all have their viewpoints and their scientific positions to hold on to. That's why the geologists will acknowledge this, that, yeah, they probably were built more than 10,500 years ago, but the Egyptologists deny that, you know, because there goes all of their theories and stories about Akhenaten and the Pharaoh and Nefertiti and Queen, you know, Cleopatra.
They have to rewrite the whole thing.
You know, they have to go back and rewrite their book, so they're not about to do that.
Oh, that's an excellent point, actually. Well, how old do you think the Sphinx really is?
More than 10,500 years, and apparently, by the best estimates, the Great Flood occurred about 12,000 years ago. So sometime between 12,000 and 10,500 is when they constructed the Great Pyramid.
That is so interesting. I think based on the research of Graham Hancock and others, we do get a picture of this advanced civilization that existed back there in that time frame, in antiquity. And they were apparently very spiritually adept.
Mm-hmm.
They also possessed incredible psychic ability, as well as technological genius. So, you know, of course, I think of the psychic Edgar Cayce and how he said they'd used a kind of combination of sound and mental power to build the Great Pyramid. You know, if that's an alien monument, we'd have to wonder what it represents in our time and how it was even constructed.
If you go to the Farsight Institute website, I notice they have a remote viewing of the Great Pyramid.
Yeah, that's Courtney Brown's project.
And they have stated that, yes, it was built many, many years before we think it was, and that aliens were involved, and that they had a technology that levitated these stones to some degree, and that they didn't have to carry them. They just maneuvered them into position.
Interesting. I'll post that link to the Dark Journalist Facebook page. Now, Jim, my last question for you, and it's been really great having you here to go deep on these important subjects. I wanted to ask you about Richard Thielman.
Yes.
And now he's made some extraordinary claims to you, and
right,
he's really shared some powerful supporting information. Can you just give us a brief outline here of his story?
Because his is a fascinating story. He entered the Navy in the 70s, back before digital technology. And so, but he says all his paperwork and the hard copies of his military experience were all scrubbed. And then that, of course, has allowed them now to say that, well, he was never in the military. In fact, one of the big things that the debunkers latch onto is that he has an ex-wife who's told somebody, no, he was never in the military. But what Richard explains is that he was operating sheep dipped, if you know what that is, which is they're out of the military, but they're still secretly working for the military. Mm-hmm. And so the military disavows them. And so he carefully instructed his wife to tell everybody that he was never in the military. But there's other things that tend to show he was. There are pictures of him in his uniform. There are pictures of him with medals. He even got accused of stolen honor, stolen valor, I think was what they call it, when you claim that you have some medal, some honor, and that you don't really deserve it, right? And so, in fact, somebody even notified the FBI. And, okay, so they went and talked to Richard, and then they went away and left him alone.
So they were satisfied. Yeah.
They were satisfied that there's something there. And there's so many other things. The fact that he has been in highly classified military installations, he has been in contact with very high-ranking military leaders. And so what's the hot deal about Tilghman? Well, back in 2008, he said, and this has been reported, that there was a briefing for the United Nations with representatives from France and Russia and the UK. And basically the briefing was, hey, UFOs are real. There are aliens. They are visiting the Earth. And this is going to become public before too long. I think one of the dates given was 2017, which is, hey, we're getting close, right?
Definitely.
And so they said, it's time that we brief you on this so that you can go back and start telling your leadership so they can start conditioning your people for the idea of this knowledge of that we're not alone. Okay. And of course, when he publicly stated that, or when he was quoted saying all that, that immediately brought the trolls and the deniers and the debunkers out.
Big time.
And they're doing everything they can to disparage him. But I think the fact that he was investigated and nothing ever happened shows you that he really is the real article. And of course, he said that he's actually been to space.
Huh.
And that he went on an alien spaceship.
Really amazing.
And went to the planet Venus, as a matter of fact. And just told all of this interesting stuff about space. And even was giving a little look into the future of the Earth.
Okay. And how's that looking?
Which seems in doubt.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think he and some of the people he's talked with have said that we're kind of on borrowed time here, that these aliens are studying us very closely and trying to decide if we're worth saving. You know, do they really want to give us technology and help us have a big leap forward, you know, so at the risk of ourselves using them for weapons and blowing ourselves up? Do they really want to waste their time doing that? Or can we grow and mature and maybe get advanced technology and not use it to either blow ourselves up or to control and subjugate other people, you know?
It makes sense.
It's a good question. And I'm not sure they've reached a conclusion on that, although as I understand it, I think the final disposition is today is that they're just kind of hands off, and they're going to let us do whatever we're going to do, and they're going to see if we're going to be able to get our act together, or we're going to just have a big war and blow everybody up, you
know? Non-interference.
So it's up to us.
Yeah.
We can't look for our brothers, space brothers, to come and save us.
One last thing on Tilghman. There's something interesting and unusual about his anatomy.
Right. Well, they said that because he was going in this alien ship and was going to be at this base on Venus, that they had to operate on him and so that he could withstand the rigors and changes of both the trip to space and the base there. And he showed me a scar that went from the bottom of his neck all the way below his navel. And it was really incredible because as an old police reporter, I have sat in on autopsies and I've seen plenty of people's scars, and I've seen open heart surgery scars, which are usually, you know what, only about that long.
Yes.
The only scars I've seen that are as long as the one I saw on Richard Tilghman are autopsies.
Wow.
But it couldn't have been an autopsy because he was still walking around.
Right. So they definitely altered him. And the point is that they altered his organs so he could survive these long space journeys.
Well, I think they implanted something. I think they put something in him that allowed him to cope with it. That's been several years ago that that happened. And the older I get, the more I forget.
I don't know about that. I mean, you seem sharper than ever to me. Well, that is an intriguing story about Thielman, and let's work on getting him to come forward and tell his story here.
That'd be great, and I don't have any way of contacting, but I may have a way of contacting people who are in contact, and I'll put the word in, see if he might not be willing to come out. I know several years ago, well, 2008 or so, there was a huge outcry, you know, oh, he's a hoax, he's a phony, caught all kinds of problems. And But I'm thinking today, with all the stuff that's come out, what we know about today, Kennedy assassination, 9/11, all these false flags and all this lying and propaganda that's going on. And there are more and more people waking up. I think there's a general consciousness raising going on in the American public for sure. Don't you agree?
Absolutely. There's no question.
Yeah. And so. So I'm thinking today, maybe, maybe he would be more agreeable to coming out and telling his story.
That would be fantastic. Jim, excellent having you on the show today. Just incredible new research. And of course, Alien Agenda, just a classic book that really set the tone for a deeper understanding of UFOs and advanced technology and the big picture.
Alien Agenda.
Well, I have my copy right here. Just a great book. Of course, anyone can find your books at jimmars.com.
Right. Amazon, any bookstore.
Amazon, right. And of course, you have some major conferences coming up here in 2016. We're going to do some together, actually.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for being here today. And it's always very enlightening.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Terrific. Have a great afternoon over there.
All right. You too.
We'll definitely talk soon.
But hey, this was really fun. Anytime you want to have a talk, Liz Holler, we'll do it again.
Will do. Thanks, Jim.
Okay. Adios.
Thank you for joining me for this fascinating episode on Akhenaten, Alien DNA, and Remote Viewing UFOs with best-selling author Jim Mars. You can find more special reports, interviews, and documentaries at www.darkjournalist.com. You can also subscribe here to our YouTube channel for the latest videos. See you soon.
Dark Journalist will go there. The deepest issues, the hardest stories, the biggest secrets. The truth is never easy. With top guests, like former Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz.
Catherine, who is really behind this media censorship?
Internet feeds go through satellites. Who controls the satellites? It's the Pentagon.
Legendary investigator Graham Hancock.
Graham, this cataclysm must have destroyed an advanced culture in our ancient past.
It truly was an extinction-level event. It was accompanied by massive animal extinctions. It was accompanied by huge and unexplained sea level rises and then a sudden plunge of global temperatures.
Best-selling author Jim Mars.
Jim, don't these elite corporate owners need us around to buy their GMO food? Why would they want to depopulate?
Because they are eugenicists and they believe that they need to purify the human race. And if that sounds like the Nazis, that's exactly what it is.
Coast to Coast AM investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe.
Linda, how are we going to scale that wall of UFO secrecy?
Humans themselves are beginning to dismiss all of the policies of denial and lies.
Dark journalists will go there. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special winter discount available for just $39 for one full year. You'll not only receive access to the complete audio archives to stream or download at your convenience, you'll also get exclusive subscriber-only content and Dark Journalist event discounts. Sign up for our free newsletter to stay updated on the latest shows. Dark Journalist, let's get the real story in 2016.
You know, we need dark journalists, so just keep doing what you're doing.